In Thai language, there are two kinds of friends spoken of, and the terms are translated into English, it would be something like an eating friend and dying friend. An eating friend is someone who's your friend when there's something to eat around, by extension meaning a good time friend, someone who's around when everything's going well and then disappears as soon as things get heavy. The other friend, dying friend, is a friend who would die for you. Obviously, the eating friends are a lot easier to find than dying friends. And sometimes think of those phrases and reflecting on our Dhamma practice and how many of the virtues or the practices we've developed tend to be refuges to us when things are going well, but disappear as soon as things start to get tough. And the image that I have in my mind of this is one from a scene in a movie which I saw many, many years ago. And in this particular film, this particular movie, the hero, is played by Woody Allen, was a prisoner in a jail, and he thought up a very clever idea to escape. He managed to get hold of a bar of soap, and he carved the soap into the shape of a handgun, and then he got some boot polish and painted it black so it looked just like a revolver, and he planned his escape really well. And then the night that he was planning to make his getaway, of course, there was a very heavy rainstorm. And just the image of him standing there with his gun, trying to look really fierce and frightening, and suddenly, as the rain came down, the black boot polish starting to run down his arms, and then the soap, and eventually the revolver just disappearing into a soapy suds. And it's one of those things that images that when you see it, you think that it has some kind of importance or resonance, but you don't know what it is, and something stores it away, and maybe it's a long time afterwards when you realize what it was illustrating to you. And I remember in the early part of my practice sometimes feeling like I'm using the Buddha's teachings, rather like Woody Allen was using his soap revolver, since it started to rain, then it would dissolve. And of course, this is why we have to put so much effort into our practice, because these dhammas that we have discovered, these teachings, are still very fragile. They still dissolve very easily, don't stand up to adverse circumstances very well. And we have to nurture them and protect them. And in certain cases, we have to very humbly accept that there are certain things that we can't handle yet, certain things that our minds are not strong enough to deal with yet, and on in certain matters, avoidance is the wisest policy. And knowing exactly the way in which to relate to various phenomena or various problems that arise in our practice is an aspect of wisdom which we have to give a great deal of attention to. And those of you who are familiar with the Sabbasava Sutta, remember that the Buddha gives many different methods of dealing with asavas or their manifestations. For instance, some things are, as I said, to be avoided. For a monk, they're like parajika offences. Walking along the edge, too close to the edge of a cliff would be a practice to be avoided, not one in which you would just endure or practice letting go, for instance. Certain things had to be endured, heat and cold, hunger and thirst, and so on. Certain things are to be used mindfully, wisely. So with regards to food, clothing, shelter, medicines and so on, one can't let go of those, even though they're part of the sensory realm. One cannot, being our bodies are part of the sensory realm, they have to dwell in the sensory realm, and we have to have some kind of association with those things. And so Buddha taught the principles of yoniso, patisankhara yoniso, wise reflection on the use of those things which have to be used, have to be made use of. There are other asavas which are dealt with by gradual reduction and wearing away at them through our practice. So there's not just one blanket practice to be used in all circumstances. But what we are seeking to develop is a sensitivity and an awareness of the nature of the conditions with which we are faced, and having the knowledge and the strength of mind, integrity and the faith to practice, to relate to that condition, phenomena, problem or whatever in the correct way. And with the development of mindfulness and wisdom, we do develop this sense of what is and what is not appropriate. And that saves us a lot of frustration, because if we lack that wisdom faculty, then sometimes we can be enduring things that should be cut off. Or we may be trying just to cut off things that should be endured. We may be avoiding things which may have to be used in a mindful way. Or we may be trying to be mindful and careful in our usage of things which should be avoided altogether. We come again and again back to the importance of right view, which is the wisdom faculty, of course. So if we are experiencing difficulties in our practice, recurrent difficulties, we have to take up that difficulty and start looking at it from various angles. In certain cases, it may be the difficulty of one who's using a soap revolver in a rainstorm. So we have the teaching, we're doing the right thing, but we're not applying it in the right way. We're lacking vigor in our application. We're lacking integrity, continuity. And so instead of the real thing, the real Dhamma, through our slack grasping of it, we end up with a poor replica. It doesn't do the job. Other cases, we can be using the wrong Dhamma for the job, the wrong tool for the job, one that doesn't is not suitable. Or perhaps we take up a particular Dhamma without a full understanding of its relationship to other Dhammas, those Dhammas which are its foundation, which support it, and those Dhammas which have to be abandoned in order for it to work for us, and we're not perhaps aware of its purpose, its goal, its function. In a number of cases, Dhammas are of the nature described in the Buddha simile of the chariots, where one chariot covers a certain part of the distance to be carried, and then a fresh chariot takes over, like a relay. And so it can be in Dhamma practice, various Dhammas that are used in the Dhamma practice have a kind of a relay function. So there's a lot of attention needs to be given to this kind of subject. For instance, if we're practicing and we're getting stuck, then we may take the indriyas as the basis for our investigation of where the problem is. For instance, we have trouble maintaining mindfulness, and so we go from mindfulness. What is the foundation for mindfulness according to the five indriyas? Virya. Is our mindfulness slack because we are lacking in vigor? Is there some way that we can put more effort into practice, because right effort will naturally support right mindfulness? But if we find that there is a lack of effort and that we can't seem to do much with willpower and adhidhana and so on, then we go back a step further and we come to faith. If right effort is lacking, we can't seem to get it together really to put any concerted effort into our practice, then we may ask ourselves whether the faculty of faith is weak. Now, faith here may be of different kinds. And say the basic underlying faith of a Buddhist, Tathagata Bodhisattva, faith in the enlightenment of the Buddha, faith in the enlightenment of a human being, faith in enlightenment of Buddha as a human being, therefore faith in the human potential for enlightenment, faith in our own potential for enlightenment. So, do we have that kind of faith, or are we getting caught up in a self-critical kind of mind state, thinking that we can't really do it, or that our problems are too intractable, or generally taking a very dreary and depressed view of things. If we are, that means at that particular moment, the faculty of faith is lacking. The faculty of faith is lacking, virya is lacking, sati is lacking, no samadhi, no panya. Faith, importantly, in our meditation object. How much faith, how much confidence do we have in our meditation, in the meditation process? How important is it to us? Do we really think that the practice of our meditation can lead us to enlightenment? If we don't, then that means the mind is lacking in faith. And when it's lacking in faith, then energy is not going to be there. Energy is not there, we cannot maintain sati. Because these are all tamas that go against the stream. They're not things that just will arise naturally. Their opposites arise naturally. Lack of faith, laziness, heedlessness, distraction, delusion. These things arise very easily. They're natural to the untrained mind. And those virtuous qualities which oppose them, faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, panya, are brought into existence with difficulty. So the very fact that one finds practice difficult is not surprising, and in fact it's what gives it its spice, it's what makes it so challenging and enjoyable. If it was easy, it would be really boring. I mean, why would you want to do it if it was so easy? It's the challenge of it. And I think for myself, I find this just flips the whole thing over. From looking at something as a problem and looking at it as a challenge. It's just so easy once you flip a problem over into a challenge to feel strengthened by it or to feel inspired by it and for energy to arise. If you look at something as a problem, then you may feel oppressed by it, depressed by it, you may feel discouraged by it. If you see something as a challenge, then it brings out the best in you. Here again, we ask ourselves with particular things that we're working with, how do we look at them? How do we articulate to ourselves this particular phenomena? Do we feel weighed down by it? Do we feel oppressed by it? Do we feel averse to it? Do we think it should be some other way? Do we think we have a right to have things easier than they are? So how we actually look at practice, how we feel about our practice, how we articulate our practice to ourselves, are not commentaries extraneous to the practice themselves. There is a there is an important relationship going on. In other words, how you feel about your practice, how you interpret your practice, has an effect on the practice itself. It's a two-way thing. And can bypass quite a lot of suffering by skill in our way of looking at things. And this is what the Buddha called yoniso manasikara, the ability to use thought wisely and intelligently. And if we don't, it's not that the mind rests in neutral state, but thought will become at yoniso manasikara. Because if thought is not guided into a wholesome strain, it will take the path of unwholesomeness. So we keep coming back to our practice and using the wisdom faculty to evaluate and to adjust and adapt and to develop this awareness that I was saying, to know what things have to be endured and what things have to be cut off and abandoned. And those things which the Buddha repeated continually as extremely dangerous, detrimental, and to be cut off without a moment's hesitation are the various kinds of miccha sankappa, or wrong thought. To say thoughts of sensuality, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty. Those are not things just to be patient with, to abide with and let them pass away by themselves. There are certain kinds of thoughts, perhaps, which that might be appropriate. But with sexual fantasy, thoughts of hatred and ill will and planning to hurt or to oppress, or to get one's own back, or making any kind of plans and forming intentions in order to hurt. These kinds of habits are extremely heavy kamma in the mind, and they intoxicate the mind, make it lose its sense of balance, lead it into hell realms very easily. So the Buddha said, at the moment that we become aware of such thoughts, we cut them off without a moment's hesitation. We give no harbour to them. And so, in our practice, we need so many different kinds of qualities. We need a vast array of tools or weapons. So we need at the same time both this warm and gentle kindness, compassion, forgiveness, and at the same time a ruthlessness of mind as regards unwholesome tamas, particularly the proliferation of the unwholesome. And through it all, we have this develop this strong wish to be free of cyclic existence. And what is cyclic existence? That is the attachment to form, to feelings, to sensations, to sankharas, to consciousness. That's cyclic existence. And through constantly reflecting on the suffering of attachment, not just as a theoretical study, but through one's own experiences. Seeing clearly. Then gradually one turns away from things. But it's not with aversion, in the sense of vibhava tanha, but it's more as if one's driving along a road and there is a left turn or a right turn ahead, and maybe the left turn looks a beautiful way to go, trees and mountains and beautiful views, but it's not the way you want to go. So you don't feel, well, I could or I couldn't. You make a definite choice not to go that way because you see that it's not the way that you're going. It's not the way that you want to go. And so you turn away from that path. But the mind is cool. There's not the heat, the movement of aversion. There's no need to be angry or feel any ill will. A path to the left is just a path to the left. And a path to the right is just a path to the right. But they're not the way you want to go. So the forms, feelings, perceptions, sankharas, various kinds of consciousness, they have pleasant, attractive, lovable, enticing aspects. Well, piya rupa, sata rupa, but they're not where you want to go. Because you've been doing that for so long. This is where the kind of reflection on past lives can be useful. If you can hold that in your mind, you've been attaching to these conditions. Life after life after life after life after life after life. And where has it got you? And all the pleasures, all the wonderful experiences, where are they now? A few memories knocking around somewhere? And in times of pain and distress, how much good are they to you? And the darkness and the confusion and the loneliness and the anxieties and the worries and the fears, and the depression, and when all those things arise in your mind, Where have all the past pleasures, where have all the good times gone? What can they do for you now? Nothing. Of the kinds of happiness that are available from grasping at, attaching to the pleasant aspects of phenomena, which lead us to put that down. But we see that forms are just forms, sounds are just sounds, odors are just odors, tastes are just tastes, physical sensation, they're just that. They're just part of the material world. Well, they're just tamada, you say in Thai. Ability to see things as tamada is a valuable one. Because the moment there's craving in the mind, the moment there's attachment in the mind, those things aren't just tamada, they aren't just ordinary, they aren't just the way they are. They automatically grow in significance. One way of talking about attachment is that it confers a spurious significance on phenomena, a significance they don't have of and by themselves. It's something that we project onto them. We give them importance. We give them a meaning. And so this is perhaps why in some religious traditions they talk about everlasting heaven and hell. It's because when you're really happy, then it becomes your universe. And it seems that it's going to last forever, or you hope it's going to last forever. And when you're in hell, it seems you've always been in hell and always will be. But seeing things as tamada, or the Pali is tamata, means that you're aware of phenomena for what they are. When the habitual kind of thoughts come up, it shouldn't be like this. Why me? How could he do that? He shouldn't have said that. That's disgusting, that's awful, that's completely inappropriate. These kinds of judgments are all based on the feeling that things should be other than the way they are. Guilt is based on the feeling that we should have been other than the way we were. We shouldn't have said what we did say. We should have said something that we didn't say. In other words, we should have been somebody. We should have been better than we actually are. But the understanding of tamada is that things are exactly this way because of the causes and conditions of which they are the manifestation. When you understand that causes and conditions are this way, then we can see at this moment, it could not be any other way. How could he possibly act in such a crude, gross fashion? Well, because of all the causes and conditions behind that. It may be right back to things that happened in past life, or in this life, in his childhood, or it may be due to some illness that's causing him to act in a very unpleasant way, or a particular mental state. But given the way the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, and vijnana, which make up that person, have been conditioned, then that was the perfect manifestation at that particular moment. Now, teaching yourself to be able to see things in terms of causes and conditions, to see things as the only or the perfect manifestation of the causes and conditions in existence at any one time is not a practice that takes you to a kind of dull passivity. You know, well, that's the way things are, and they'll always be that way. What it means, it's like that, it's like this, at this moment, because causes and conditions are this way at this moment. But causes and conditions change. But the principle is that only when the mind has realized equanimity, that it can respond in an appropriate way, in a creative way. So this is directly opposes a view which is quite common in the West these days, that you have to be passionate before you can get anything done. And I saw one of the best-selling Dhamma books of the last year. It's called Passionate Enlightenment. Everything, even enlightenment, has to be passionate before it can be meaningful. And one is to be passionately involved in something is highly praised. Dispassion is not a word that one hears bandied around very much. But the idea that only positive change, action, can only spring from passion. But the Buddha said that action springing from passion will always be slightly distorted. It will never quite fit the situation. It will always lack a certain circumspection, a maturity of vision, a clarity. Whereas the way to resolution and the way to peace lies first in the recognition and acceptance of the situation as tamada. It's like this because he or she thinks like that, because of past experiences, past conditions, past situations, and so on and so forth, have culminated in this moment, in this particular phenomena. It's tamada. Now when with the recognition, acceptance of tamada, then aversion and various unwholesome tamas are abandoned, the mind enters a cool state of equanimity, just as a car shifts into the neutral gear before going on to a higher gear. So equanimity is the prerequisite, or is the stage leading on to the active stage. The active stage may be one of speaking or keeping silent, of doing or not doing, of coming or going or staying, or whatever. But that state, for it to be the appropriate one, must spring from equanimity. Now, basic truth of the human mind that the Buddha pointed to very often was that wisdom and compassion are inseparable. in one of the traditional similes, we have the giant bird, the great eagle, with two wings. One wing's wisdom and one wing is compassion. And the Buddha pointed out that the more clearly you see things, the more clearly you see yourself, the more clearly see particularly the nature of suffering, the more clearly you see how suffering is conditioned by desire born of ignorance, the more clearly you see the efficacy of the Eightfold Path in alleviating that, and you begin to see cessation. The more you understand the Four Noble Truths, the more compassion you feel for yourself, and the more compassion you feel for other people, and indeed for all sentient beings. I feel this is a crucial point that, and one which we can apply to our own minds, that the test, if you like, of the wisdom that you have developed through your practice is the amount of compassion. And a test of the compassion in your heart, whether it's true compassion and not mere pity, not sentimentalism, is the wisdom faculty. Where there's true wisdom, there is compassion. Where there is true compassion, there is wisdom. Compassion lacks wisdom, it can do more harm than good. And we all know the old English saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And this is a major problem when people have a will to help and to do good, but they lack wisdom. Perhaps they conceive themselves as possessing compassion. What happens is they try to do good, to help, without understanding their self, their own mind, their own motives, their own defilements, without understanding the people they want to help. They have no sensitivity to time and place, and to their own capacities, to the person, the community. And so they don't have the results that they hope for. And they become disillusioned, angry, hurt, offended. And people say, well, who is it that says that good actions have good effects? I've done all these good actions and had no good effects at all. And then when there's criticism, such a person will feel even more hurt and will feel that his good intentions or her good intentions justify the actions based on them. As to say, the action must have been correct because it was based on a good intention. The person is quite sure that their hearts were pure in their intention. The purity of intention is not enough. It has to be based on wisdom. And wisdom, particularly wisdom understanding the nature of suffering and how suffering is brought and comes into existence and how suffering is alleviated, and true understanding of suffering. So the more you look at yourself in practice, the more you see suffering in all its myriad forms, from the gross to the very subtle, and the ubiquitous presence of tanha every time we suffer, and every moment of suffering. We see how unnecessary it is and deep compassion arises for ourselves and for other people. In fact, the distinction between self and others becomes far less rigid, may almost disappear. And we, as our mind becomes firm and strong, bright and powerful through our practice, at the same time, paradoxically, it becomes incredibly sensitive to suffering. We find suffering intolerable. And the inability to withstand suffering is a sign of a compassionate mind. So the practice is one whereby through the threefold training, sila, samadhi, panya, we're gradually freeing the mind and giving it a true independence and integrity. We are increasing its wisdom and understanding of the way things are and a sense of compassion for all sentient beings, including ourselves. And these are the three qualities, of course, which are most prominent in the Buddha himself. So as you practice, try to look at your practice as a challenge. When any particular problem that comes up, that's your challenge, that's your practice, that's not a distraction from it. And sometimes from these particular challenges we can learn a lot. Since we may see a particular kind of habit or imbalance becoming clear in our formal meditation practice, which is a major habit pattern underlying our whole life. If you see some kind of recurrent pattern in that way, it's obviously very unlikely that it's going to be restricted to your meditation practice. It is symptomatic, usually, of your whole approach to life in general. Because it's like in meditation, you're looking through a magnifying glass at the germs, at the things which cause you suffering. So you can learn a lot from what is preventing you from realizing samadhi. It's a lot to be learned. So beginning to see whatever arises, whether it's niwaranas or bojangas or whatever, as tamada, these are conditioned phenomena. They are like this. They are this way because they are conditioned phenomena. And this is not a teaching of a general conditionality. It's a specific conditionality. Things are specifically conditioned. Each phenomena has certain specific conditions for it to be a certain way. And it's because there is a specific conditionality that there is a way of practice. If things are the way they are because everything is the way it is, then we're in trouble. But because phenomena exist depends on certain specific conditions. That there is a way of entering into the stream of causality and affecting it in a positive way. So through the recognition of things as being tamada, we remove the instinctive emotional reaction to it, whether of like or dislike, reach the state of equanimity, and from equanimity, from the neutral state, then the mind can shift into the active mode, which is most appropriate to dealing with that phenomena. If it's an unwholesome phenomena, in order to abandon, let go of it, or a positive, wholesome phenomena, to mindfully encourage it and develop it. And the more and the closer we look, the more we understand, the more compassion arises in the heart. So if wisdom is being developed or practiced, it's not just a one-sided development. It includes the whole being, because wisdom and compassion are the two birds, two wings of the bird. And at that point, I'd like to leave the evening talk.